these things all the time.
I'm not sure if I can, whether I can live up to that or not, but I'm trying. So we might as well start by reciting the Vajradhara lineage prayer.
Yeah.
earth is perfumed with scented water, strewn with flowers, adorned with mountain air,
the four continents, the sun, and the moon. Imagining this as a Buddha field, I offer it, so that all beings may enjoy that pure realm.
In accordance with the capabilities and the diverse aspirations of sentient beings, I ask you to turn the wheel of Dharma, of the greater, lesser, or conventional vehicles.
First of all, please think to yourselves that we must do something to benefit all of our mothers, all sentient beings throughout space. The only thing that will bring them true and lasting benefit is if they achieve the state of Buddhahood. And so in order to bring them to Buddhahood, we need to achieve Buddhahood ourselves. And so think to yourself, in order to achieve Buddhahood, we need to practice. And if we don't know what we're doing, we can't practice, so we have to study first. And then so that is the reason why we are gathered here to study the Dharma today. And so I'd like to ask you to please listen this morning with this attitude of bodhicitta. And the Dharma that we are discussing is the instructions on parting from the four attachments. And so we've got the text by Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen, who is a great Sakya master. And the parting from the four attachments teaching, where this comes from, is Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen's father, Sachen Khunga Nyingpo. So Sachen Khunga Nyingpo was, from the time he was very young, it was pretty clear that he was an extraordinary being, and he went to study with a master named Bari Lotsawa, Bari the Translator. So how many of you have read The Life of Milarepa? Yeah, okay. So do you remember the story when Milarepa's sister comes up to the mountain and says, "You're living here on nettles. You should be like that translator, Bari the Translator, down who has, you know, a big retinue and sits on a high throne and people playing trumpets and everything. You should be like that." That's the same Bari the Translator. Okay. So in that story, it doesn't sound like he's that great a being, but actually he was a very important master. In the new transmission of the Dharma. He just had a different way of approaching the Dharma than Milarepa did. At any rate, Khunga Nyingpo was his student, one of his students. And when Khunga Nyingpo was 12 years old, Bari Lotsawa told him that in order to study well, he needed to practice Manjushri. And so he went into a Manjushri retreat, and also his lama, Bari Lotsawa, was with him. And so they did a retreat for 6 months. And after 6 months, there's a little obstacle that happened in the practice. And the stories, the accounts I've read have not clarified what this obstacle was. At any rate, he did the practice of Achala, who's a wrathful deity, for a little while, and that dispelled the obstacle, and then he was able to accomplish the practice. And after he had accomplished the practice, then Khunga Nyingpo saw in the sky Manjushri, who said to him, "If you cling to this life, you are not a practitioner. If you cling to samsara, you have no renunciation. If you cling to your own aims, you have no bodhicitta. If you have grasping, or if there is grasping, it is not the view." And so Khunga Nyingpo realized that this is the essence of all the Dharma. It's the essence of all the Dharma, particularly the sutra schools, but also the Tantra. And so he taught this widely. And he taught this to his son, Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen, who wrote this relatively short text that we have here, which was then passed down. It's like one of the main instructions in the Sakya lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. So we've got the Kagyu, Nyingma, Geluk, and Sakya tradition. And so in the Sakya tradition, this is like one of the main texts for mind training. In many ways, it's parallel to the four dharmas of Gampopa that we have in our Kagyu tradition. It's teaching essentially the same thing, although in a different way, with slightly different emphasis. But it's basically talking about we need to be free of different types of attachment, because if we are attached, whether to this life or to our own aims or to samsara or to anything at all, then it's going to prevent us from achieving Buddhahood. So this is the parting from the four attachments. So it's the primary text for mind training in the Sakya tradition. And so it's been passed down through the Sakya tradition, this earlier this year at the Kagyu Munlam, or at the end of, right around New Year's time, actually last year, last winter, the Sakya Chizen came to the Kagyu Munlam in Bodh Gaya, and he gave an empowerment at that time. But on the side of giving the empowerment, he also taught this text to Jamgon Rinpoche, Jamgon Kontro Rinpoche. And Jamgon Kontro Rinpoche then taught this during the Kagyu Munlam. I received it from Jamgon Rinpoche, who received it directly from Drapa Gyaltsen, if not from Drapa Gyaltsen, from Sakya Chizen, who has an unbroken line of it from the Sakya Drapa Gyaltsen. So that's how I came by this teaching. And when thinking about things that we could talk about here in Portland, it seemed like a good topic, given the constraints of time with my schedule. I don't know if it's a whirlwind like Steve described it. But at any rate, I don't always have a lot of time to come here. And you all, of course, have busy lives as well and may not have so much time. So for a teaching that we can fit in one day that will also be beneficial to us, I thought this is a good one. And one of the main reasons for doing this, I mean, first of all, I don't have a lot of experience with the higher teachings and I'm not really qualified to teach them. But also, listening to Rinpoche teach and talking with a lot of practitioners, we hear a lot about Mahamudra, Dzogchen. Or if you're doing studies, you hear about Madhyamaka and these very, very high teachings. And there's a real tendency to go straight for these teachings because we recognize that they are valuable, and they are extremely valuable. They're wonderful teachings. And most of you have been to retreats with Rinpoche or with other great masters, and you know how beneficial they are. But sometimes it's really difficult for us to keep it up. You go to the teaching, you have the teaching, it's wonderful, you feel like you've really got something out of it, and there's this glow that lasts a little while, and then 6 months later, where are you? And so this is something that actually Rinpoche has talked about quite a bit. And he's many occasions he said that it's often due to not meditating enough on impermanence. The other thing he says, it's from a not enough study. So we're not going to engage in any heavy-duty study today because we don't have the time. But we can talk about this text, which really focuses on developing the right motivation for practicing the Dharma. So if I sound like a broken record, I know that last year I came and I spoke about impermanence, and I'm speaking about impermanence again. The time before I came, I talked about karma. I'm going to talk about karma again. So I'm going to probably sound like a repeat to many of you. But the reason for this is that it's easy to understand on an intellectual level. It's much harder to actually really incorporated into your being, and that's what we have to do in order for our practice to go well. So I think what I'm going to do is go through the text, and as we go through the text, then I'll make a few comments here and there, and then we'll I might elaborate on a few things as I sometimes do. So it starts with a verse of homage. So it says, I go for refuge from my heart to the kind spiritual master and compassionate Yidam deity. I pray you grant me blessings. So this is Drapa Gyaltsen, and his spiritual master is his father, Sachen Kungan Yimpo. And the compassionate Yidam deity here for Jesen Drapa Gyaltsen is Manjushri. So going for refuge to these deities, it's like many Dharma texts begin with an homage. One of the main reasons is so that the teaching, so that they'll be able to complete the text well, so that they'll have a good motivation while writing the text. So this is why it begins with an homage. And also, it's always good to start, when you do anything, remembering the qualities of the masters who've come before. So for most of us here, this is Trungpa Rinpoche and Kempo Karta Rinpoche. If we think about what they have done in their lives, and I think actually Kempo Karta is a very good example for this, because he's someone who was not recognized as a tulku as a young boy. Unlike Trungpa Rinpoche, who was recognized as a tulku and given special training, Kempo Karta Rinpoche, though I don't know his life story, he's someone who started out as a fairly regular and I think fairly wild Tibetan boy from stories that I've heard. But he went through the training and really practiced it hard and achieved a great result of it. Because he did that work, he has been able to bring great benefit to thousands of people over here. Trungpa Rinpoche will say about himself that he was recognized. He may not have been an actual tulku of the Trungpa Tulku, but he was recognized as the Trungpa Tulku and given an opportunity, and he took that opportunity and he used it and practiced and studied and developed himself as much as he could, and then remembered the instructions when times got hard, and through doing this was able to come to a great result. And look at what he's done in this lifetime. So this is just remembering this example is important for us, because sometimes we might doubt whether we can do it. But the examples of masters like Kempo Karta and Trungpa Rinpoche shows us that we can do it. They started out as ordinary beings. Maybe Rinpoche started out as an ordinary being a few lifetimes before. But at any rate, he was at one point an ordinary being just like ourselves. He had the same difficulties as we do, the same types of attachment. And so if we are able to eliminate our attachments and practice the Dharma, then we will be able to then we will be able to achieve the same result. So that's why we start with the homage. So the next verse is the pledge to compose, and it sort of gives the reasons why Drapa Jelson is composing this. There is no need for non-dharmic conduct. To accomplish Dharma properly, I'll teach the instructions on the parting from the four attachments. I ask that you please listen. So here, there's no need for us to do anything non-dharmic. There's no need, and so non-dharmic means anything where we're acting on the basis of the afflictions, the greed, hatred, desire, envy, pride, wrong views, and so forth. If we're acting on those, then the actions that we do will naturally be unvirtuous, and so we don't need to do any of that. This means that, like in terms of our livelihoods, we shouldn't have like a non-dharmic livelihood, like, I don't know, drug dealing or prostitution, or being a butcher or things like that. You can all look at your livelihoods. You know, there's a certain degree when you're engaged in a worldly livelihood, there are different degrees of livelihood. Sometimes, you know, there are a lot of people who are involved in business, and in business there often is a really gray area. A lot of you I know are involved in more helping professions, shall we say. In helping professions, it's still that you generally have a livelihood that's good. But you need to make sure that when you're doing it, you have a good motivation, that you aren't solely thinking about the paycheck. At the end of these 50 minutes, $75. Or I don't know how much you get these days, but, you know. So, at any rate, so in order for us to practice the Dharma properly, we need to be free of attachment. And so that is why he's teaching these instructions. And so Drapa Jelson asks that we listen. And so then come the four instructions. These are the four, this third stanza here. If you cling to this life, you're not a practitioner. Don't panic. If you cling to samsara, you have no renunciation. If you cling to your own aims, you have no bodhicitta. If there is grasping, it is not the view. So, if you cling to this life, you are not a practitioner. I think for a lot of us who come to the Dharma in the West, this sounds like a pretty extreme statement, because a lot of us still do have a lot of attachment to our lives. And so there are a couple things we need to figure out. We need to figure out what is the attachment that he means here, and what are the degrees of attachment that we can have, and what can we do to overcome the attachment that we have so that we can actually truly practice the Dharma. So the next sections of this text go through each of these instructions one at a time. And we talk about, first there's a section about clinging to this life, and then a section about clinging to samsara, clinging to our own aims, and then having grasping in general. And these are sort of like the sequence that we need to go through on the path. This is similar in the four dharmas of Gaumbhapa. First you have, may the Dharma become the Dharma, or may my mind become the Dharma. So may the Dharma become the Dharma, and may the Dharma become the path, may the path clarify confusion, and may confusion arise as wisdom. So these are really very similar. So the first one, if you cling to this life, you're not a practitioner. So the particular clinging that we mean here is the clinging to the things in this life that prevent you from practicing the Dharma. And in general, this means clinging to fame, money, wanting more of these, wanting to be popular, doing things in order to have more comfort in this life. And basically, it's the eight worldly concerns. If you are attached to the eight worldly concerns, that's the problem with the eight worldly concerns, is that they prevent you from practicing the Dharma in the first place. And even if you do practice the Dharma, they corrupt your motivation. And so you're not really practicing the Dharma properly. So the first of these is in the next verse, reads, if the first is discipline, listening, and contemplation, and meditation without attachment to this life. So generally, when we practice the Dharma, it's as Vasubandha wrote in the Treasury of Abhidharma, with conduct, listening, and contemplation, completely train in meditation. So our stages of practice as we move through the Buddhist path means that first we have to have conduct. This means discipline, and primarily the discipline of giving up wrong actions, which is the discipline of holding the various levels of vow. And many of you have the five lay precepts, or you might take the Mahayana Sojung vows from time to time, or so forth. And so that means keeping those vows that you have for the time period you have, turning away from wrong conduct. It also means, you know, when you're not, if you don't have the lay precepts, but if you have the Mahayana Sojung, if you take the Mahayana Sojung vows from time to time, it also means, you know, that you give up, that you try to avoid doing harmful things, harmful actions during the times that you aren't actually keeping the vows. Like on days when you're not keeping the vows, that doesn't mean that you're free to go out and murder people on those days, right? So that's conduct. You know, so you give up killing, and not just murdering people, but also killing other beings as well, and stealing and so forth. So that's conduct. And then listening is studying. So studying, and that means that when we study, we want to make sure that we have the right attitude towards studying, the right reason for studying. And that studying, it's before we can practice, we have to study. We have to learn what's going on. We need to learn the Buddhist terminology. We need to read the texts. We need to read the writings by current masters and by past masters, the teachings of the Buddha themselves. And then once we've learned those by listening to them or reading them, then we need to contemplate them, because a lot of them are very easy to understand but difficult to actually get into your heart. Like the teaching on impermanence. Everything is impermanent. Everything compound is impermanent. This is incredibly easy to understand, but it's very difficult to actually incorporate into your heart so that it really affects your behavior. And then after you've done that, and you've thought about things, you really incorporate into yourself, you have real certainty, then you can really meditate. So that is why Vasubandha said, with conduct, listening, and contemplation, completely trained in meditation. So in order to do those properly, as Drapa Jasin says, we need to do without attachment to this life. So if you practice those with a focus on this life, you are not a practitioner, so give that up. So what you have to give up is the attachment to this life. So there are different, as I mentioned, there are different levels of attachment here. You might look at this and say, oh my God, how am I ever going to give up attachment to this life? I'm not a real practitioner, or they think I'm not a practitioner. This teaching can't be for me. But actually, it doesn't mean that you should have absolutely no attachment to this life. If this teaching were saying that you should have absolutely no attachment for this life, for the pleasures of this desire realm, then basically we'd be saying that you have to already be on a fairly advanced level before you even begin practicing. And that's not what this is saying. The attachment we need to be free of is the attachment that will prevent us from practicing the Dharma, and that will corrupt our Dharma practice when we do this. So, you know, this is attachment to money, an attachment to a nice home. You might want to keep yourself in a nice house that's maybe a little bit more expensive than you could afford. So you have to work extra time in order to afford your house. Because you're working more time, you have less time for Dharma practice. You might really crave your cappuccino, so you go to Starbucks 3 times a day. That's $12 a day. We all know about the Starbucks effect. $12 a day, that's $100 a week. That's like thousands of dollars every year for your coffee habit. Okay, we're in Portland, so you have to go to, what is it, the one on... Yeah, you all know what I'm talking about. So the more money you drop there, the more money you have to earn. And that means you have to go to work when you're working. I mean, okay, many of you are in helping, you know, I mean, I know a lot of you are in helping professions, and so you can practice bodhicitta and so forth and practice compassion while you're working, which is very good. But, you know, you might get home from 8 hours healing people. And after you've been healing people all day, all you want to do is kick your legs up and sit back and... So, you know, if you have to look at your habits, if your habits are keeping you from practicing the Dharma, you need to maybe think about, well, maybe I don't need so many cups of coffee at Arabica. Maybe a once a week the treat. But then if you decide, well, I'll do the once a week treat at Arabica, but I'm going to buy the expensive Keurig coffee machine with the little packets that only cost $1 a cup, you're still going to drop a lot of money on the Keurig coffee. So, anyway, have I digressed already? But that's the problem. But the other problem that sometimes we practice, and I think Drapa Jalsen's text here is really for people who've already started to practice. Probably he wrote this primarily for monks and nuns, because it's talking about what is the reason for practicing discipline, listening and contemplation and meditation. And what he says here is to begin by discussing discipline. It is the basis for gaining the higher realms, the stairway to accomplishing liberation, the remedy that eliminates suffering. Discipline is indispensable. So discipline here is, as I mentioned before, discipline is keeping the vows, your refuge vow, any of the pratimoksha vows like the lay precepts or the fasting vows, and then the bodhisattva vows. So keeping those vows that you have and practicing and really being careful of your precepts. And if you keep these vows, then that is the cause so that in the next lifetime you'll have a good chance of being born human. So it's the basis of gaining the higher realms, or being reborn as a human or as a god, or sometimes as a demigod. I don't think that being born as a demigod is actually all that great a rebirth, because they spend so much time fighting, according to the scriptures. So being born as... I mean, if you're born in the god of the 33s, there are lots of stories of the gods in the 33, the heaven of the 33, who practice the Dharma. But they have to have started in a human lifetime. So being born human is best. But if you want to be reborn human in the next lifetime, it is imperative to practice discipline now. So it's a stairway to accomplishing liberation, because if you aren't born as human, then you can't take the next step to getting on to practicing in the higher realms. And it is the remedy that eliminates suffering. Suffering comes from bad actions, and bad actions come from not refraining from them. If you refrain from bad actions, then you will not experience the suffering that comes from bad actions. So it is the remedy for that. So discipline is indispensable. Now, we all know this, but sometimes our discipline gets a little bit corrupted, and it gets corrupted by attachment to this life. So as Drapa Gyaltsen said, but discipline that is attached to this life is the basis for accomplishing the eight concerns. You criticize those with poor discipline and are jealous of those with discipline. Your own discipline is hypocritical. It is the seed of accomplishing the lower realms. Give up such fictitious discipline. So this really talks about, basically, as it said, being hypocritical. Your own discipline becomes hypocritical. If you are trying to keep someone else's vows and you are not keeping your own, you don't care about it. This is actually something that's very common. People don't really worry about their own vows, but they are very, very concerned about other people's vows. People are very, very concerned about monks and nuns who don't keep their vows. They get very upset about it. They get very upset about people like Catholic priests who don't keep their own vows. And, you know, on a level, there are good reasons to do that. But if you do that and you don't take care of your own vows, then what good is it? You may be so attached to the pleasures of this life that you can't refrain from, you know, stealing a little bit or lying a little bit in order to benefit yourself and breaking one of your precepts. So you have to be very careful about that. If you're going to take the precepts and keep them, it's important to keep them properly. If you can't keep a precept, then you probably shouldn't take it. You should keep some precepts because otherwise it's hard to have real discipline. But if you aren't able to prevent yourself from lying, then don't take the precept on lying. If you can't keep from drinking, if you're an alcoholic, don't take the precept on not drinking until you have come to a point where you can really keep it. Because it's far worse to take a precept and then not keep it, because you've made a promise and then you break it. And even worse is if you make a promise and then break it and hide it and then castigate other people for not keeping that precept. So that's just, like, rotten to the core. we've got to be careful about what we do. When we take precepts, we need to take them seriously and try our best to keep them as well as we can. So that's with discipline. And it's similar with our study. One more thing about discipline. It's sometimes in Dharma groups, you might worry about other people and talk about other people. This person has taken the five precepts but isn't really keeping them. That's not a basis for criticizing anyone. You can only keep your own vows. This is something that back when I was in Cheddar, before I took the monastic vows, one of my classmates said to me, and it is so true, you can only keep your own vows. So keep your own vows and don't try to keep anyone else's. And if you do that, not only is it good for you in this life, you know, in terms of, you know, karmic results for a next lifetime, it also makes everyone get along better. Mm-hmm. And getting along in the Dharma group is one of the most important things you can do. So that's discipline. So the next is listening and contemplation. So listening is reading and studying, and contemplation is thinking about it over and over and over again until you've really internalized it. So someone who listens and contemplates has the riches of accomplishing knowledge, the lamp that dispels ignorance, the lamp of the knowledge of the path that guides beings, and the seed of the Dharmakaya. Listening and contemplation are indispensable. So in order to progress along the Dharma, along the path of Dharma, we don't know where we're going. So we need to follow the instructions of the people who've gone before us. We need to follow the instructions that the Buddha gave. We need to follow the instructions that have been passed down through the Sangha through the ages. We need to follow the instructions of the great masters, like Rinpoche, the two Rinpoches, Gyalmo Karmapa, whomever, the Sakya masters, whatever lineage. We need to follow their instructions. We need to listen to them. We need to understand them. So this means that we need to do a bit of study and studying the text, studying the teachings about the various practices that we do. I know a lot of you have been doing the Ngundra practices, the preliminaries, and so, you know, you study the torture's true meaning, you study the words of My Perfect Teacher by Pato Rinpoche and the various other texts. You think about the meaning and you do the practice. You can also study some of the texts on some of the philosophy if you are inclined. Even if you're not inclined, it's good to take a look at them to just sort of get an idea of what's going on. And so when you do this, then you have the riches of accomplishing knowledge. So it's like a great wealth. That it's the wealth that can't be taken away from you, because you learn something and you really internalize it, and then it's better than a jewel. You might lose a jewel. One of my great uncles fled Portugal. He was a duke in Portugal. Actually, it was a step with my grandfather's second wife's uncle. He fled Portugal with diamonds sewn into the hem of his coat, and he went to Paris. And every few years, he'd sell another diamond and live for a few years. And so, those diamonds, if he had lost those diamonds, he would have been a pauper. But you can't lose the diamond of the knowledge that you gain. So this is a great knowledge, a great jewel that you can't lose, and it dispels ignorance. Obviously, when you don't know anything, and you read it and you find out, it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. So that's like a lamp that's gone on. The knowledge of the path that guides beings. So it's knowing this helps us progress down the path towards Buddhahood. And the seed of the Dharmakaya. The seed of the Dharmakaya means this is the seed of us accomplishing Buddhahood. So it's in listening and contemplation are indispensable. But someone whose studies are focused on this life has the wealth of accomplishing pride, scorn for those with little study, and jealousy for those who have studied. They seek followers and possessions. It is the basis for accomplishing the lower realms. Give up study. That is the eight concerns. So this is like when you study in order to become an important person. You know, someone... And I think we can look at the transmission of the Dharma to the West, and we can probably all think of various lamas or various Western people who've gone and studied a little bit and come back and taught and gotten into trouble because they've studied and learned something, and then they set up a study group perhaps earlier than they should and then get into trouble with their students of the opposite sex, or maybe their students of the same sex. Or maybe they get into other various types of trouble. And that becomes from, getting too attached to this life and becoming, trying to make themselves into a lama before they're really ready for it. This is, of course, not talking about all Western teachers. And it's not, there are plenty of Asian teachers who have the same issue. But I just think that the Western teachers whom you've probably read about are maybe a more visible example. But you might look at this and you might think that, well, this is only people like that. I'm never going to set myself up as a lama. But when I go to study group on Wednesday night, I know more than... You might not ever say this to anyone, but you might have this thought in your mind. Oh, I've read this. I can talk about this at study group. I can talk about this on Monday nights. You know, this is something that will help other people and they'll look up to me. So you have to be careful when you're looking at these things, because actually that sort of, I mean, when I'm talking about it, it sounds a little ridiculous. But really, it actually does kind of sneak in. It's a very, especially when you get put up in a situation like this, for me, you know, it's a dangerous situation. But even within study groups, you know, you can take a look and you can start to think, if I've been studying for longer, I know more than this person. Well, actually, we really have to be humble. It's like, which is it? It's in the eight verses of training the mind. Always be humble. Always take a humble position, right? The Geshe Langri Tampa, that Tulku Tamcha was talking about it. Always take the humble position. So you should, when you study, yeah, you've studied, but, I mean, do you think you've understood it completely? Probably not. And so if we have the humble attitude and are more interested in the learning than getting anything out of ourselves, then our study will be more beneficial for ourselves, and it'll also be more beneficial for other people, because when you go in there on that. I mean, you've probably been aware of this in study groups. Oh, there he goes again. There she goes again. He goes, whoever it is. There it goes again. You know, talking about this. Gosh, won't he ever stop? You know, so when you talk about things with that attitude, people can hear and they won't listen. They won't be able to listen. So you should be careful of that. You know, even within the group, always be humble and listen to what other people have to say, because they may have some good insights as well. And so that's with the study. And then the next talks about all those individuals who meditate have the antidote that eliminates afflictions, the basis for achieving the path to freedom, the seed for accomplishing Buddhahood. Meditation is indispensable. So we all need to practice meditation. We all understand this. And there are a lot of benefits. It's through the meditation that we're actually able to subdue and then actually eliminate the afflictions. That's how we gain liberation for ourselves. It's the way that we accomplish Buddhahood. So it's indispensable. But we have to be doing it with the right attitude. If you are meditating focused on this life, if meditators focused on this life have distractions, even in solitude, no matter where you go, you might be thinking, when I finish this retreat, I can go to Arabica. should I have their double espresso or the macchiato or, you know, maybe they're going to serve a flat white. Maybe, you know, I don't know. If you are focused on this life, and it just makes you more distracted when you're meditating, you won't really be able to focus on your meditation, not just when you go on retreat, but even in your own daily practice. So the recitations are meaningless talk. This means that you're reading the text, and it's like, I remember that. When I was young, this, that, and what am I going to do tomorrow? So your mouth is working, and your mind is elsewhere. So at that point, there's not a whole lot of good to it. And this is a difficult one when you're involved in daily, we go and we do work. We're attached to our work because we want to do a good job. But when you come home, often it's really hard to turn it off. And then when you sit down and you meditate, you've got all of these things that are happening in your life, whether it's work or maybe some sort of family thing or whatever. These are worldly parts of your life, but they come up in our meditations. And so on the one hand, it doesn't really matter what happens in your meditation. If you come to a certain level of, if you're able to be mindful through it, it doesn't matter if you think about various things, as long as you are mindful. Because when you're mindful, then the thoughts will come and they'll go. If they aren't mindful, then they'll come and they'll stay for a long time. So it's when we're too attached, then it's harder for us to really apply our mindfulness to the meditation. And so so meditators who do this, they denigrate those who study. So they talk down about people who study. They're just a philosopher. They don't have any real practice. And they're jealous of other meditators. They're distracted in their own meditation. So give up meditation that has the eight concerns. And so here in this passage, what it's taught explicitly is the meaning of the passage with conduct, listening and contemplation, completely trained in meditation. But what this implicitly teaches is the antidote for this. And the antidote is meditating on the precious human life and on impermanence. So, at the last minute, I put together a chart for another program, but the last minute I kind of got it ready to distribute to all of you, and so you all have it here. This is about the precious human life. And you've heard about the precious human life, and I'm sure you have talked about it, but you haven't really ever seen the numbers. So thanks to Google, I am able to give you numbers. There are 500,000 Buddhists in this world. So if you are going to have a precious human life, that means that you're Buddhist and in this world, basically, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk about the eight leisures and the 10 freedoms of riches, and you should study these and you should know them. The explanations in many texts, particularly in the Torch of True Meaning, are really worthwhile to study, and you should study them. But you want to figure out what are your odds of having a precious human life. So if you are born as a Buddhist, there are 500 million Buddhists in this world. So if you're born a Buddhist or if you become a Buddhist later, your chance of being a Buddhist is 100%, right? You're already Buddhist, so there's a 100% chance that you're Buddhist. But whether you actually practice or not is a different question. So how many of these 500 million people actually practice Buddhism effectively is a good question. I would say actually a lot of them are doing things that will gather the accumulation of merit and do things that will achieve, bring them good in their next lifetimes. But the chance, that's iffy. You know, so in this lifetime, there's 100% chance of being a Buddhist, but in your next lifetime, that's what we've got to worry about. So you might think, well, in my next lifetime, I'm going to be born a human. So if you are born a human, what is the chance that you will be born a Buddhist? There are 7 billion people on the planet, give or take a few. 500,000 Buddhists, that means that 7.1% of all beings, of all humans, are Buddhist. So that's not bad. Hey, it's a 1 in 14 chance. You know, that's okay, you might think. But that's assuming that you're going to be born human, and there's still a far greater likelihood that you're going to be reborn in... how many people live in, like, war-torn countries, like Syria, Ukraine, Iraq, the Congo, or is it Nigeria, where the Boko Haram... You know, how many people are born in that? That's probably as many people in those countries combined as there are Buddhists in the world. So you've got an equal chance of being born in a country like that. And then if you think how many people are born into just dire poverty, there's a far higher chance of being born in some miserable location as a human. Your chance of being born as a wealthy human in a Western country are probably about the same as your chance of being born, a Buddhist, I would say. Maybe if you think about wealthy humans in Asian countries, it would increase it a little bit, but still not very good. So, you know, if you're born human, there's a good chance, better than nothing chance, that you're going to have a miserable human existence instead of a precious human one. Okay? But, you know, humans are actually, you know, when you get to the bardo, humans are actually a fairly small, number, and then the number of Buddhists among humans are even smaller. So one of the most common forms of life on this planet is termites. I learned in college that there is a 3-foot mound of termites for every single human on this planet. 3 feet. That's a lot of termites. And so I looked up on the internet, on Google, how many termites are there on the planet? I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of that right in front of you, but that number there, it is what, 250 quadrillion or quintillion?
Quintillion.
Quintillion. 250 quintillion termites on this planet. So when you're in the bardo, you know, the chance of you taking birth as a Buddhist as opposed to taking birth as a termite is... What is it? 5 zeros? .0000002? Is it 2.6 or 2.5? 2.6. So this is a 1 in 40 billion chance. 1 in 40 billion. Okay? Do you know what your odds of winning the main lottery are if you buy a ticket? 1 in 4.5 million. I looked that up this morning. If you enter if you look at the main megabucks, the odds of winning the main megabucks to get the jackpot, you've got a 1 in 4.5 million. You've got a 1 in 5.9 chance of winning something. But even termites, they're one of the most common forms of life on the planet, but they're not the only form of life on the planet. So here is a very, very rough estimate of the number. You can see the number there on the chart. 200 sextillion, or hexillion, whatever they're called, sextillion? 260 sextillion chance.
Whatever that means.
Whatever, it's a huge number. And so what is your chance of being born that? It's like one... Oh, that's right. The chance of being born... If you're the... Oh, no, you said... Oh, thank you. At any rate, it's so you've got a minuscule chance, one in billions, one in many hundred billions of a quadrillion trillion chance of being born a human as a being born an animal. And so this would probably include things like krill, termites, ants. You know, there are tons of krill. Think how many krill a sperm whale will swallow in a single gulp. You know, and there have got to be a whole lot more out there, otherwise they'd all be eaten up by now. So, you know, these are just the chances of being born human on this life. And this is not counting any of the other worlds and universes where there are various animal lives. This is not counting the hungry ghosts who are far more numerous than the animals, or the beings in hell who are even more numerous than that. So you just look at it, you know. What is the chance? There are two ways that you need to look at this. The first is, how lucky are you that you were born here? You've got a 1 in 40 billion chance that you were born human instead of being born a termite. So now that you've had this lucky opportunity, you've more than won the jackpot in the lottery. If you win the jackpot in the main megabucks lottery, you get a lot of money and you will be bankrupt in 3 or 4 years because you don't know how to use it properly. This is what happens to most lottery winners. They end up bankrupt. Or actually, I don't know if they end up bankrupt, but they end up no happier than they were before they won the lottery. But you've been born human. Now, sometimes you might wonder, you know, okay, I started Nundro 5 years ago and I haven't finished, or maybe I started 10 years ago and I haven't finished. I'm kind of wasting my time. What's going on? Well, you should think like that, of course. I'm not going to stop you from thinking like that. But you need to be encouraged also. So thinking of meditating upon the precious human life is thinking how lucky you are to have come to this life, to have connected with Buddhism, to have connected with Thangka Rinpoche and this center, and have a chance to practice. I mean, this is just such an incredible fortune and such a great chance. The very fact that you have done this means that in some lifetime, not necessarily your next lifetime, but in some lifetime, you will awaken to Buddhahood. You will continue this connection to the Dharma. Whether it happens in your next lifetime depends upon what you do now in this lifetime and how you train yourself in this lifetime. So you can take heart in just the fact that you are here. You can take heart in the fact that you started. This is an incredible thing on its own. So you should not be discouraged on any level. But you also have to, you know, you have to take a look at the odds. Okay, I've won the jackpot this lifetime, but am I going to win it in my next lifetime? That depends on what you do now. So it depends upon you maintaining good discipline. It depends upon you actually doing your practice, taking advantage of the situation that we're in now. Because if you don't, you know, there are, what, 21, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 20 heptillion animals on this earth, and only 500 million Buddhists. And that's like a minuscule percentage. So, you know, the chances aren't good if you don't do something about it now. So now that you have this opportunity, you have to use it. So that's the first thing that's implicitly taught here. The second thing, and when you do this, I think that really helps get down the if you really think about it all the time, if you're always thinking about how fortunate I am and how much you have to take advantage of this fortune, then you're going to think, should I make myself a cup of tea or should I start practicing? Okay, I'm going to start practicing. I started thinking about this a little bit more, and it's like, I'm not going to shave every day. I'm going to start practicing half an hour earlier. You know, not that shaving takes half an hour, but when you start shaving and then taking care of yourself, like it ends up, you know, half an hour between getting up and sitting down and meditating. So you just get up, just run some water over your face and sit down. It's much faster. And I don't care if I have a little 5 o'clock shadow every other day. So, you know, things like that. You know, when you really realize what a chance you have and you want it, then you don't want to waste it. Then you'll take advantage of it. So this is why it's so important to think about how fortunate you are. So how do you do this in your daily life? I mean, you can think about these numbers, and on one level this is kind of amusing, but if you really think about these numbers, and to make it, but still numbers are kind of abstract. So you can you can do what, when I teach in Hong Kong, I call these MTR meditations because you can do this on the MTR, the metro line. Mm-hmm. We don't have a subway in Portland. And even if you go to a crowded place in Portland, it's not crowded compared to Hong Kong. But there are places where you go and you can see people walking by. How many of them actually have a precious human life? Now think about that. I mean, there are going to be people, among the people walking by, there'll be, you can't tell, looking at someone in the outside, are they Buddhist or not? You know, it's not like you can smell Buddhists. You know, there's no, I mean, sometimes you'll see people walking around with big malas, you know, dressed in the robes. They've got that white robe on, you know, okay, they're Buddhist. Or you see them coming to the group, and in the study group, and you think, that's pretty good. But if, you know, you walk around, if you go through Hannaford's or wherever, you go to Hannaford's on Friday, that's probably your best place to do this meditation. Hannaford's at Friday at 5 p.m. Go shopping then, because it's the worst time to go shopping. The place is packed, I believe. I imagine it's probably packed. Everyone is doing their weekend shopping on Friday night, or maybe they're doing it on Thursday night. You go at that crowded time, and just look at how many people are there, and look at how harried they are. Look at what they're doing. Then think to yourself, I've got this opportunity to do something about this for myself and for them. They don't have it yet, but if I do this, it'll be good for me, it'll be good for them. If I really devote myself to the practice, you know, so you can choose to go grocery shopping at crowded times for that reason. Or, you know, you might walk by the bait shop, look at all those worms. You know, you go by the seafood restaurant. Have they got glass tanks here? I don't remember. The lobsters, they do. You know, you go through the market, and you'll see plenty of fish there. And, you know, think, what is the chance of being born a fish compared to being born a human? How fortunate you are. So use the things you see in your daily life. Now, another thing you can do to help bring this into your daily life is, I mean, you can use technology to help yourself. And one way is by making reminders for yourself on your smartphone. This is very effective. After the last time I saw my dentist, she said, you should make a smartphone reminder in order to remember to floss. Uh-huh. And it works. I get that reminder and I get out the floss. So you put a little bit of a reminder. Remember how precious this opportunity is. And it'll go off every day at whatever time you have it go off. You might like have it set for 10:30 in the morning, in the middle of, you know, if you're working at a desk job. If you're working in a classroom, or, you know, if you have clients, then you don't want to set it at that time. But you can like set it at a time when you know it's going to ding, and you'll see, remember how precious this opportunity is, or anything like that. Something that speaks to you about the precious human life. Remember that you have a 1 in 40 billion chance of being born a Buddhist as opposed to being born a termite. You know, put something like that on your smartphone, and then you will think about it and you'll remember it. If you put the humorous ones, actually, maybe sometimes they'll strike you more, but you've got to really think about that meaning. I mean, what's it like to be born a termite? To have to eat wood all the time? No coffee for them. So meditating on impermanence, or meditating on precious human life. So that is good to give you enthusiasm, but sometimes we get too enthusiastic. And so one of the big problems we have with the things in this life is when we get attached to them, then it prevents us from practicing. It's like, you know, when I talk about Starbucks or Arabica, I talk about the amount of money that goes in and then you have to work. But there's also the fact that I'm going to practice, but I'm going to have a cup of coffee first. Or I'm going to have a cup of tea first. I'm going to sit and read this article. I'm going to look at this article on my smartphone. That is the worst, you know. And so we need an antidote for that. And that antidote, for one thing, with a smartphone is turning it off at night. I said this last year, but it really works. You've got to turn off all the internet connections. So that means that you have to turn off the Wi-Fi. That's usually easy to turn off. The second thing you have to do is you have to go into the settings and look under your cellular and turn off the data at night. Turn it off at 7 p.m. and turn it back on after breakfast, or maybe just before breakfast. And then you will be like, you'll sleep better. And when you get up, you won't be able to look, you know, you look at your cell phone, I don't have a separate clock, so I look at my phone to find out what time it was, and I won't see that, you know, so-and-so sent me a message. It'll just say that. And if I want to look at a message, I have to actually go through and push a bunch of buttons to, in order to turn it back on. So it discourages me from doing that. And so that doing that has made a huge difference for me in terms of just being able to get up and not get sucked into the iPhone at 5:30 in the morning. Instead, to put it down and actually get into practice. But in order to really make it work, you have to meditate on impermanence. You have to remember that this life, this opportunity we have, is not going to last for very long. And usually we get started late. And it's not just in this culture. Rinpoche was reading a biography of a lama from Amdo. This lama wrote that he spent the first 20 years of his life not even thinking about the Dharma. Then he spent the next 20 years sort of learning about the Dharma, you know, learning a bit about it, but not really caring about it. Then he spent 20 years thinking, I really should practice the Dharma. And only then did he begin to actually practice the Dharma. And how old was he? 60. So if you start practicing Dharma when you're 60, it's a lot harder. I mean, and a lot of you know, I didn't start until I was 30. You know, a lot of us from this culture, we start late. So we got less time. I mean, we live longer, but I mean, if you haven't started earlier, if you're going to start practicing Dharma when you're 80, that's a little bit late. So you got to start now. And we don't even know if we're going to get to 80. You know, okay, I'm 48 now. Am I going to live to 90? Lobsang Dorje said that I have to stay in my room in Namo Buddha until I'm 90. And I'm thinking to myself, am I even going to make it to 90? are we going to make it to 90? We don't know. And when you make it to 90, I mean, I'm watching my parents and grandparents go through the process. I don't know that I'm going to be able to do much. Sitar Rinpoche was very funny about it. He was saying that when he gets to the age of 90, he's going to be not much more than just a bowl of soup. You can't do anything. You're just sort of sitting there, a blob. So what are you going to do? So if we want to practice Dharma, we have to do it now while we are able. And, you know, particularly a lot of us are getting along. You know, my hair is white. It used to be blonde. Just thinking about this. So the way to do this, of course, you should look at the teachings on this in the traditional texts, like the Torch of True Meaning. He's got wonderful explanations of how to meditate upon Dharma, upon impermanence. And many others do. There's the advice from a yogi, which are you going through that this fall? Or are you?
We're talking about it.
You're talking about it. Highly recommended. Of course, since three of us who worked on it are here, you definitely have to. Two of you worked on it. You have to support your colleagues' work and go through this new book of Rinpoche's. But before you go through it in the group, you should get it and look it through and read it, because a lot of it is about impermanence. All rivers flow to the same place. And just as birds must fly from the treetop, we all have to move on. A lot of really good examples for thinking about impermanence, and that's the main message of that book. But it's really important. So, like, you could do one thing. The way that book is set up is there are 100 different instructions, 100 different verses, and you could take these verses and read one a day, because they're generally pretty short. Some are like four paragraphs long, but most of them are like a paragraph. So you can read a verse, read it in the morning, think about it all day long, then read it again in the evening. And if you do this and then think about impermanence, I spoke about smartphone reminders. You can take your favorite verses about impermanence and make them smartphone reminders. You know, it's like I've got one that comes along every morning. Remember from your heart that death is certain. You know, you just think about this. And if you, it's also good to change them every once in a while, but to do things like that. And then look around you. Look at the people you know. Look at the people in your life who were once hale and hearty, young, youthful, vigorous, and now what are they like? Look at the ones who were babies who couldn't do anything, and now look how big they are, and look where they're headed. think where you were headed, think of the changes in your own life. You need to use the experience in your own life. And when you go to Hannaford's on the most crowded time of the day, you can go around and you can look. What is happening with these people? How old are they? The elderly people aren't going to be going at Thursday at 5 o'clock. That's the working crowd, although some of them are going to have gray hair. You can go at times when a lot of elderly people might shop and look and see people who have trouble, you know, walking through the store. People who need to have the carts with the wheelchair, the carts with the wheelchair, mm-hmm. And, you know, they're getting by and they're doing it. Good for them. But it's not easy. When you get to that point, are you going to be able to do even a single prostration? You know? And are you even going to get to that point? Think about the people in your life. I mean, all of us, I'm sure, know people who've passed away. In this culture, it's less. You know, I've thought about it. In The Torch of True Meaning, there's a passage that says, the people you know who have passed away are more numerous than the people who remain living. So in the context of 19th century Tibet, when Jamgon Kondro Rinpoche wrote that, it was a context where people would grow up in large families with high infant mortality. And this is still the case in many of the Himalayan regions. The family will have 9 children, 4 will survive. And all the families around are like that. So literally, it's true for someone in that context. And this is the context that it was for most of human existence until very recently. Even in this country, I would imagine, until sometime in the 20th century. So think about it. You know, we're very fortunate to be in this society where we're relatively healthy. And, you know, I didn't have more than a handful of friends die until I was 30. But we do know people who've died young. So just keep, and, you know, I have nearly been hit and killed twice in the last 2 years by cars. Partially that's because I'm, you know, a space cadet, not paying attention. But it's just the nature of life. We don't know, I mean, you don't know anything that's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to wake up tomorrow. Or if you're going to wake up tomorrow, it could turn out that you have stomach cancer, you know, or something. You know, you might be feeling a little off for a few days and you go off and you find that you've got stage 4 of this or that. There's plenty of stories of this happening. So we've got to make use of the time that we've got now. Because we just don't know how long it's going to be. And if we don't know it now, if we don't take advantage of it now, there's chances of it happening. So this is a great antidote. When you start thinking about coffee versus practice, or whatever you're attached to versus practice. If you think about how much coffee have you drunk in this life? How many cappuccinos do you really need? But how much practice have you done? Have you drunk more cups of cappuccino than you have done prostrations? You know, this is a good question. No. So what this does, when you think about impermanence like this, it shifts your priorities. But you have to think about it every day. You have to think about it all the time. And you can't stop. You can't think, okay, now I've really got it, because you have to really, really get it in order to do it. So when you do that, this is what we're talking about. If you cling to this life, if you're attached to this life, you aren't a practitioner. So if you are so attached to cappuccino or whatever it is, that you are unable to practice, that is the attachment to this life that we're talking about. If you are so attached to this life that even when you're trying to, when you appear to be doing practice, you're not really fundamentally doing practice, then you are not a practitioner. So you have to look at the attachment. We are all ordinary people, so we all have a degree of attachment. The question is that attachment preventing you from practicing or corrupting your practice when you do? And so this is something that you have to really look at yourself. And if you find that it is, then you need to really look at it and really work with it and meditate upon impermanence. Think about how precious an opportunity you have. And that will be the antidote for your practice. But it's something you've got to keep it up. Even after you think you've got it, you've got to still keep going on the meditation on impermanence. Rinpoche talks about, you've all heard Rinpoche say, it is the the meditating on impermanence is the condition that spurs you to practice. It is the rod that spurs diligence, and it is the companion to achieving the result. So what Rinpoche says here is that basically when you begin, it's because you meditate on an impermanence that you're inspired to practice. Because you meditate on impermanence, you are diligent about your practice, and because you have meditated upon impermanence, you achieve the result. What implicitly this means is that you have to meditate on impermanence at the beginning, middle, and end. Otherwise, you won't get there. So it's an important thing to do. We talk about it as one of the four preliminaries, but it's also a companion that we need to keep in our practice at all times. So that is the first of the four. So if you cling to this life... Now, one thing I also want to say here is that you shouldn't understand this as saying that you shouldn't take care of yourself. Because you meditate on the precious human body, this means you have to take care of this human life. You might feel, it means like you shouldn't be too attached to food, and you shouldn't be too attached to other pleasures of this life, but you have to take care of this body. So like one thing that comes up for a lot of people is we spend a lot of time about thinking about food, making sure that our food is just right and having good food. That is probably more attached than we need to do. We need to have good food, but you don't need to have gourmet food. You need to have, generally the food that we need is the food that's going to support us, keep our bodies healthy, but you don't have to go overboard about it. On the other hand, not being attached to food is different from losing your appetite. So there are other reasons why you might, if you find that you're just revolted by the idea of food, it's not necessarily a sign of attachment. It could be a sign of something medically wrong with you. So when you find that you have less attachment to food, you need to be careful to distinguish, is this less attachment to food, or is there something physical going on in terms of your attachment? So just keep aware. You have to take care of your body, but don't be attached to it. Don't indulge and pamper it so much, as it says in the 100 verses of advice by Padamba Sangye. Your body is just a heap of filthy stuff. Don't indulge and pamper it so much, people of Dinger. Is that how it goes? Have I remembered it right? Take care of it, but, cream. No need for facial creams, really. I'm a monk, I can say this. You can choose whether you're going to listen. where have we got to? Even though we haven't gone through all half of the text yet, I think this might be a good place to leave it off, because this is really the most important point. Not the most difficult point to understand, but the most important point to really incorporate in our beings. I'm going to keep going for a little bit. We've got until 12 o'clock total. The schedule might say that we're supposed to have question and answer now, but I want to get a little bit further in the text. So second of the four freedoms from the four attachment is if you cling to samsara, you don't have renunciation. So what we mean by clinging to samsara is thinking... In classical texts, this talks about it. It's talked about saying, if I do good in this life, then in the next life I'm going to be reborn as a god, and I'll be happy, and that'll be great. And gods have long life. I'll be set for eons if I'm born as a god, or millions of years. So this is saying that even that is not enough. So to achieve liberation, one must give up attachment to the three realms. To give up attachment to the three realms, recall the faults of samsara. First, the suffering of suffering is the suffering of the three lower realms. Contemplating it deeply will give you goosebumps. When it happens to you, there is no way to bear it. There are those who, without the virtue of keeping vows, sow the crops of lower realms, no matter where they are, how unfortunate. To contemplate the suffering of change, beings fall from high realms to the low. Indra will be reborn an ordinary being. The sun will go dark. Emperors will be born slaves. Though one can believe this from the scriptures, ordinary folk are unable to realize it. So look at the changes among humans whom you see. There are rich people who become beggars, haughty people who become weak, many people decrease to one, and so on, beyond comprehension. So We have to give up attachment to the three realms. And giving up attachment to the three realms means we need to realize that their nature is suffering. The nature of life is that it doesn't work out, that it is painful. So when we talk about suffering, sometimes in a lot of Western Buddhist things, I've only seen this talked about in Western Buddhist things. I've never seen it talked about in traditional texts. Maybe I haven't looked at the right traditions. You will see, if you look at it on various things on the internet or various writings, there are many writers who say that the word dukkha, which is a Sanskrit word that we translate as suffering, that it doesn't mean suffering, it means satisfaction, or dissatisfaction. It means everything, actually. If you read at what the Buddha said in the sutras, dukkha, suffering, includes everything from physical pain of any level, mental pain, distress of any level, up to the very, very subtlest worry. So anything along that whole spectrum is suffering. So if we look at our lives, actually everything in our lifetime is suffering in some level or another. Even the happinesses are tinged by being suffering. So some things are easy to see as being suffering. This is like pain. You get cancer, that is suffering. You have endometriosis, that is suffering. You have any number of afflictions, that is suffering. Suffering a bullet wound is suffering. Any sort of cut or pain is suffering. That's physical suffering. That is what we call the suffering of suffering. Grief is suffering. Worry is suffering. Any of these, depression, psychosis, all of these are suffering. These are clearly, we can look at that. Everyone is going to agree that, except for maybe some masochists, everyone is going to agree that those are painful, those are suffering. And this is included in the type of suffering. What we call this is the suffering of suffering. It means that this is what everyone is going to accept as suffering. So in traditional texts, like here, it says the suffering of suffering is the suffering of the three lower realms. So in the three lower realms, there's not a whole lot that is not one of these three types of suffering. In the hell realms, it's just continuous pain. In the hungry ghost realm, it's continuous hunger and thirst. And for animals, for most animals, it's continuous fear, if not out-and-out pain. I mean, most animals are afraid of being eaten. Think of those poor krill. Here comes that sperm whale. Think about that mouse that your cat. But your cat is worrying. You know, the cats are always, smallest thing, they come up and they run away. Because they're always afraid. I mean, there are a few animals that aren't afraid of much. Moose. What do they've got? Moose these days, apparently, I was reading something last year that because of mild winters, moose now are suffering greatly because of ticks that they didn't have before when winters were colder. And so think about that poor moose who's carrying, one of them that I think said, one article said they might have up to 100,000 ticks on a single moose. Poor beast. Deer are the same way. And deer are also, afraid of us. So animals, we can see the animals. The hungry ghosts and the hells are difficult for us to see, and so sometimes they're difficult for us to relate to. But you can look at animals and really see it. Even animals, I mean, if you look at, they're pampered pets, but how many animals are pampered pets, really? Not many. They're the exception rather than the norm. Most domesticated animals are... probably the most numerous would be chickens in factory farms. Probably second would be hogs in factory farms. Probably number three would probably be cattle in factory farms. What sort of an existence is that? That's suffering of suffering. And if you look at your own lives, it's a lot of pain in our own lives. I think we tend to gloss over things and we tend to forget the pain. since I'm using this example not out of personal experience, this is what many women have told me. Many of you are women, so I'm going to use the example, and you will correct me if I am wrong. Many women have said that childbirth is the most excruciating pain that you can imagine, but you forget it the moment it's done. But it's still excruciating. You still have to go through it. There are so many issues that come up with reproductive health that many women have discomfort with, you know, painful menstruation, you know, endometriosis, all of these difficult problems. And I know a lot of women who suffer through these things. Mm-hmm. And we men are not immune from it either. We have plenty of health problems that come up. We have plenty of pain in our lifetime. If you think about, okay, a lot of people say the greatest joy in their lives is their children. Well, I don't know if they're thinking that when they're teenagers. It's like, oh my God, what am I going to do about my children? It's also the greatest source of stress. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, my marriage has been the greatest source of joy, but it's not always. You know, I was married, I remember that, and, you know, there were some times when we were happy, there were some times when that were pleasurable, but if I look back honestly on it, and I thought my marriage was a happy one until I got divorced. I had no idea I was going to get divorced 10 days before it happened. And so, you know, I thought, and I look back on it, actually, there's a whole lot more stress being involved in a relationship and being married than there was afterwards. Afterwards, then there was a stress of trying to get into a new relationship. But, you know, it's a lot of work. It's stressful. It's a lot of work. Work means stress. If you want to have a good partnership, you want to put work and relationship and everything that we talk about in the society, it's work. It is stress. That is included in suffering. Then there's the suffering of change. You have something good and it changes. It's gone. And then there's the wish that it was back. That wish, that craving is painful. So that is the suffering of change. So even good experiences are, in essence, they are suffering. So that is called the suffering of change. And then the third type of suffering is the suffering, composite suffering of formation. Here in the text, to talk about the suffering of change, it gives a lot of scriptural examples, but it says, unable folk are unable to realize it. So look at the changes among humans whom you see. There are rich people who become beggars, haughty people who become weak, many people decrease to one, and so on beyond comprehension. So, Muhammad Ali, great boxer, on the top of the world, earned lots of money from prize fights in the 1970s. Where is he now? He's got Parkinson's or something. Terrible suffering. He went from being the strongest, one of the strongest men in the world, to being one of the weakest. You can look at this in your own life, people that you know. So look around you. You know people we all like to celebrate the rags to riches stories, but there have been people who've gone from being well-to-do to being just, what happened to them? How did they end up in such a state? And you probably know people like that. People who had every chance in the world and they just never got anywhere. This is suffering of change. Where it says many people decrease to one here, what that means is that you'll have a family that once had a lot of members in the family. What happens to them? They all die. Before there were a lot of people, now there are one or two left. 40 years ago at my parents' house, there was a family of five people and two cats. Now there's only one cat and two people. Many becomes one. This is the change that happens in lifetime. You can look at, there are towns that go up and down. People who've lived in Maine for a long time, I'm sure you can look at towns like, Lewiston or Auburn or any of the various Maine towns that 40 years ago were prosperous towns, big bustling towns with good employers, good wages, and where are they now? Where I grew up, there's North Adams. It was a big mill town. Everyone had good jobs. It was prosperous. And now a lot of the descendants of the people who worked in the mills are on welfare in North Adams because there are no jobs other than service jobs. This is change. So you can look at it and you can see it around you. When you drive down the roads and you see the pothole, that is change. The suffering of change is when you have to pay for your new shock absorbers after driving over the roads. And then to contemplate the suffering of formation. There is no end of things to do. There is suffering if there are many people or few. The wealthy suffer as do the starving. We spend our entire lives preparing. At the end of preparing, everyone dies. So preparing here means your 501c3, whatever. I don't know. That plan, your IRA plan, your other alphabet soup retirement plan. That's all suffering. Because you put the money in, you're preparing for the future, and you have no idea, are you actually ever going to be able to retire? Really? And then you don't even know if it's going to be worth anything when you retire. I mean, if you've invested it wisely, or if the pension fund takes good care of it, maybe you're okay, but maybe not. You know, so we spend all of our lives preparing, so then you think, okay, my pension plan's not going to be enough, I need to gather something. I won't be able to practice the Dharma when I'm old if I don't have some money on the side. So you work harder, you save your pennies, and you work hard, and then you have no time to practice, and you get to be old, and are you going to have time to practice? I don't know. We spend our entire lives preparing, and then when we prepare, once we've prepared it, we don't know, are we actually ever going to be able to use it? So we have to think about this. Preparing, and that work of preparing, it's a lot of mental stress. You've got to, okay, I'm going to check the stock market. You know, and there's just a lot of work of doing this, keeping it going. But really, the suffering of formation is the fact that everything is changing moment by moment by moment by moment by moment. Because everything is changing moment by moment by moment, then we have to do a whole lot of work to keep holding on to things, keep holding on to ourselves as we are. It's like in every single instant we're constructing our identity of ourselves, and we have to perpetuate it in every single moment, and that takes a lot of work. It's not just sort of the physical work of putting on our clothes and, you know, making ourselves look nice. It's just the work of being who you are instead of just letting yourself be. But we are so habituated to trying to make ourselves into this person whom we think of as me that we have to put a lot of effort into being who we think we are, creating an identity for ourselves. These days there's a lot of talk about identity politics and having an identity. And we're all fortunate enough that we are white, that we don't have to worry about this in terms of discrimination against us. But we all, you know, we're members of various groups. And we think of ourselves as creating an identity based upon that group. But there's a lot of work to that. It takes a lot of effort to do it. So we have to be careful of these, you know. Just everything we do in our lifetimes is work. We're just keeping it all together. And how much energy do we have in a day? And how much of this are we going to put into worrying and keeping it all together? And how much of it are we going to put into Dharma practice? That's why we have to think about suffering. The only thing that we can do that will eliminate this suffering permanently is to achieve a result through practice. And if we're going to achieve a result through practice, we have to do it now while we have the chance. So this passage. So even dead, there is no end to preparation. So once you die, sorry, you're preparing for the you're in the bardo, you're thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do here? Unless you can have presence of mind at that point and head for Dewa Chen, you're going to be preparing for the next life. And so the only way to do that is we have to make the preparations that are going to count now, and that is our Dharma practice. So how unfortunate those who are attached to the mass of samsaric suffering. For me, with my own particular physical makeup, it's very easy to see that Cappuccino is suffering. A lot of people don't have that benefit, but we have to look at it, and we have to see that the things that we look at as pleasures in this life are actually the causes of pain in the future. Whether it's pleasure, pain in 10 minutes, 24 hours, or in a year, or in the next lifetime. But we have to look and see that the things that are, you know, the pleasures of this life, if you really think that the pleasures of this life are worth it, then you should just take heroin now. Because there's nothing more pleasurable than that, they say. I haven't done it. But they say there's nothing more pleasurable. But you are smart enough to realize that if you take heroin now, it's going to ruin your life within a few weeks, if not quicker. I don't know. So, I mean, if you want to be hedonist, then there's no point to it. You can see what this brings. And other pleasures are less extreme than that, but it's really the same thing. So this passage teaches the faults of samsara explicitly and what to adopt and reject for karma and result implicitly. So I think that's enough for this morning. We have about 20 minutes left for questions and answers for you to say something. Oh, Steve has got a question.
You know, I'm going back to the part on discipline, and you had talked about the five lay vows.
Mm-hmm.
And sojong, and you know, it seems that in terms of formal commitments to discipline, you know, there's this continuum from taking refuge to geilong monastic vows.
Yeah,
and we've, in texts like Dharma Paths by Kempo Kartar, there's an explanation about the lay precepts.
Mm-hmm.
And you have more of a perspective about what's going on in Dharma centers.
Mm-hmm.
But the impression I have, and I'd be interested to know if I'm wrong, is that even very serious practitioners generally don't take the lay precepts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, I'm kind of curious about that.
Okay.
And I'm curious, you know, your perspective about, you know, the benefits of it and the obstacles
okay.
people may be encountering to taking it.
Did everyone hear the question clearly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Five lay precepts. In Dharma centers, it's a cultural thing. It's new to Western culture. And also, we frankly tend to be a somewhat hedonistic culture. In what I've remarked is that in centers where there's a large Asian population, people are very happy to take the precepts. And you say, we're giving the precepts, and then more people than signed up will stand up and take the vows. They'll just flock to take the vows because they understand culturally how important it is. But we don't understand that culturally here in the West. And so it's hard for people. And also, part of the cultural baggage is that a lot of us come from situations where people are saying, thou shalt not. And so the difference between the lay precepts and the thou shalt not is that we are not saying thou shalt not, we are saying I am not going to. It's making a choice on your own, and not a choice because someone else is saying you shall do this or else. It's because it's recognizing that if I don't do this, I'm in deep doo-doo. You know, if I don't take care of myself, if I don't take care of my actions now, I'm just going to be creating suffering for myself and others in the future. So when you, like, so a lot of people lead very ethical lives in the West, and so the Western ethics and traditional Buddhist ethics are a little bit different. The Western ethics, you know, we have this strong sense of obligation to society, to people around ourselves, and so we are generally good people because we want to be good people in relation to the society that we're in. This is why we don't go around murdering people. So people, you know, people talk about not murdering in the West in order to protect the society. But when you talk about not murdering in Buddhism, it's more an issue of this will have bad karmic effects in the future. So one big difference is that we've got to switch our moral compass a little bit. It's not that that not murdering people is not that thinking about it in terms of its societal effect is bad, but also we also do have to think about the future and the future lives. And this really comes down to how much confidence do we have in future lives. Because if you don't have a lot of confidence in future lives, then it's going to be hard to really take it seriously, take karma seriously. So you do have to think about this. I think I spoke about this a couple of years ago when I talked about karma. I spoke about it a fair amount then, and many of you were here at that weekend. Another thing you can do, you could go on to Google the source of all information these days, and Google spooky things that kids say. If you do this, you will come up with a lot of stories about children explaining things that they remember from their past lives. So you can think about various logics about a rebirth and so forth, but you can also should maybe do this, because a lot of people do find it easier if you look up spooky things that kids say, and I have done this myself. The reason I've done this is because I have more than once seen this as a headline in Facebook. Mm-hmm. And not just the same page. So if you email this, you will find research. And last summer in August 2014, there was a lot of press about a psychologist whose name I was going to look up this morning, but I didn't, and I still don't remember it. A psychologist at the University of Virginia who's continuing work from that was started by Reverend Ian, not Professor Ian Thompson was his name. At any rate, there's a psychologist who's published stories of children in the United States from European stock who remember their previous lives, and the stories can be corroborated. The one that got the most press was the kid who remembered his previous life as a Hollywood agent. Looked at the picture and said, "Oh yeah, that was my friend Mike and George," and you know, see, looking at the picture from the 1930s Hollywood paper, something like that. I don't have the specifics right, but that's the general idea. And then the story about the kid who remembered being a fighter pilot in World War II. Well, what happened to you? I was shot down. And the kid remembered this, you know. So you can look up things like that, and reading these stories, I think, is something that gives a lot of people help. Also, there's a lot about it in Sogyo Rinpoche's book, Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. So having confidence in past and future lives really does help when you think about taking the five precepts. Now, the five precepts are refraining from killing, refraining from taking that which is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from lying, and refraining from alcohol and intoxicants. Many of us are not able to give up all of them. So what you can do with the five lay precepts is you can take one of them. Like with killing, what breaks the precept is murder, or killing a human being intentionally. So basic murder. Murder or war. I don't know if they consider war murder, but at any rate, giving up human beings. If you can think, if you're not going to murder anyone, you might as well take that vow. Why not? Gain the merit for free. If you avoid murdering someone, but you don't take the vow, you don't accumulate the negative karma of not killing, but you do not gain the positive karma of keeping the vow. And it is that positive karma of keeping the vow that will then, is the positive thing that causes rebirth in a good place. So it is important to do that. If you are not going to steal, and most people here, I don't expect anyone. How many of you are addicted shoplifters? You know, are you going to? I'm taking it as a given that you aren't going to steal, that you aren't going to rob a bank. But are you going to go shoplift? No. So why not take the vow? You know, I mean, it just makes sense. You know, you're not going to do it anyway, so you might as well get the benefit of not doing it. You know. Most people are not going to commit sexual misconduct, so why not take the vow? You know, okay, lying's harder. Alcohol and intoxicants are very difficult in this context, but there are a lot of people who have given up alcohol already for various reasons. And if you've already given up alcohol and intoxicants, why not take the vow? Just take what it is. So the example Rinpoche gives: you've got the cat lying there. Having a sweet dream. Is the cat killing anyone? No. Is the cat accumulating merit? No. You have someone who has the vow, taken the first lay precept, I'm not going to kill anything. As they're sleeping, are they not killing anything? No. Are they gaining merit? Yes. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Every single moment that you keep that vow, you are gaining merit. So at this moment, you know, as a bhikkhu, I'm gathering merit for just keeping the vows. As at this moment, those of you who have the lay precepts already are gaining merit. So why not? It's not that hard. You've already, basically, by living what people in this society would consider an ethical life, as I'm sure most of you do. I don't want to know about your secret lives. You're keeping the vow anyway, so you might as well take it.
So what if you break the vow? If you've taken the ring?
With the lay precepts, if you take the vow and break it, then it's bad, but it's not as bad as if I break my bhikshu vows. That's the good thing about the lay precepts. If you take the lay precepts and you find that you break them, if you break one of them, you've only broken that one. You can confess it, and you can take the vow again, and you can purify the karma. Maybe do a few extra Vajrasattva mantras, really concentrating on what you've done wrong. It's, of course, good not to do it. If you take the vow and you find yourself so tempted to break it that you don't think you're going to be able to keep it, then you can give the vow back, which means that you can just go to someone who understands and say, I have this vow, I can't keep it anymore. And that cancels the vow. Like someone such as myself, or even, you know, someone, a friend in the group, or someone who's understanding. You don't want to go up to some stranger in the street and say, I have the vow against killing, but I can't keep it. And also, if you're afraid about being able to keep them for your life, there are the eight fasting vows or the Mahayana Sojong vows, which are essentially the same that you can take. Amy?
Thank you for this is great. Thank you so much for the teaching. It's really, really timely. But I don't want to deflect from my own issues, but we're talking about impermanence, I couldn't help thinking about Trungpa Rinpoche, and I miss him a lot. I don't get to see him very much. And I was wondering if you could give us an update on his health and maybe some of his recent activities, you know, highlights of the last couple of years or whatever you wish to say about him. That might, you know, be nice for us to hear.
Rinpoche is extremely healthy. And, I mean, he's now 82 by Western counting. So as an 82-year-old, he does have issues because he's 82. This is the nature of being 82. But he's strong. He's healthy. He's got a lot of energy. He's been teaching recently, not as frequently as before, but with a lot of vigor and really a lot of energy in his teaching. So, and he's taken care of himself. He went decades traveling around the world, eating more than he should have, at least in part because he was always given more than he should have been given. But eating, you know, not taking care of himself much. Then, you know, he'd go someplace and someone would say, you need to do this for your health. And then he had too many doctors and too much medical treatment and not really, you know, doing things for others. He was accepting medical treatment and medicines because people were giving them to him, not because he needed them. And now he's stopped all that. He exercises. He's been to a lot of physical therapy, and he does things to keep himself strong. And he's cutting back on his activities so that he can maintain the activities that he's doing. So this is the reason why you haven't seen him, is because he's not traveling for 4 months a year teaching. He goes to a few places every year. And in the past couple of years, he's come to places that are relatively close, and so many of you have been able to see him. Some of you have gone a long way to see him. And of course, if you, coming to Rinpoche's teachings and wherever they're given is always a great thing, whether it be Vancouver or in India or Nepal. But he's generally doing great. You look like you almost have a question. No? You're sort of raising your hands like, no. Anyone have any questions? It's not rocket science what we've been talking about. Oh, Donna.
Sometimes I guess I've maybe taken the vows to an extreme place, which I don't think is a bad thing necessarily, but are the lay vows not meant for things like if I see a penny on the street, I don't touch it? Whereas I used to pick them up and say, oh, my lucky day. You know, things like this, I feel like, well, that wasn't given to me.
It means taking things that are unowned. Taking that which is not given means that if there's something that someone else owns, and then you take it, then it's a problem. If it's a question of it's not owned by anyone, then it's not breaking the vow. Now, in terms of like finding a penny on the street, we can be pretty certain that when you find a penny on the street, the person who dropped it is not going to miss it. So that's not a big deal. But if you find... My sister was actually talking about this. She does an exercise with her seventh graders. What happens if you find $10 on the street? What happens if you find a bank envelope with $150 in it? What are you going to do? And so with a bank envelope with $150 in it, you know, that's someone else's money. It's probably better to take it to either the organization where, you know, if you found it in a store, take it to the management of the store or to the bank or to the police or something, because that's obviously something that's owned. But if you are walking along and you find a penny, or if you find a lovely apple that has just fallen off the tree, it's probably not a bad, not a problem.
I've been staying away from those things.
Yeah. It's good to be careful.
Yeah.
Good to be careful. But you think, is it owned or unowned? That's the big question. And if it's owned, then you shouldn't take it, or you should do something to help it return it to its proper owner. Yes?
Thank you for the teachings. They're wonderful. And I'm wondering about the good fortune of us not being born as termites in this life, and that as a motivation for thinking of future lives, my kind of wily mind can then get into it being more motivated out of fear for not becoming something, you know, kind of less than in another lifetime than this lifetime. I guess I was just curious what your thoughts would be next.
That's good. Do you want to be a termite? Raise your hands. I want to be a termite in my next lifetime.
No, but if you're using fear as a motivation, that's okay?
That's fine. There are three motivations for going for refuge. Fear is one of them, and it's okay. It's okay, you know, I mean, let's be honest. Why are we practicing Buddhism? Because we don't want to suffer in the future. You know, that's what it is. You know, sometimes it comes down in Buddhism, in our culture, it's kind of getting watered down. We want to have less stress in this life. But that's not wanting to suffer in the future. Traditionally, it's not wanting to suffer in future lives. And that's not wanting to suffer in the future. And so that's okay. Yeah, I don't want to be born a termite in my next life. I don't want to be born krill. I don't want to be born a shrimp. I don't want to be born a shark. I don't want to be born something worse. I don't want to be born in Syria. I mean, would you want to be born in Syria? That's just like everyone wants to avoid suffering and get away and gain happiness. And that's our motivation. We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't want to be happy. So that's okay. Yes.
So to understand that, I can think about not wanting to be born as an IRS agent.
Right.
Okay. Or a CIA employee or something like that. A krill, you know, I mean, there are things I don't know about being a shrimp and things I don't know about being a krill. Okay, truly. Or a termite.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that. But and I, you know, the IRS, you know, the CIA, things like that, I know I don't want to be
yeah.
born as one of those. So I guess my question is, you know, there are all of these kind of cultural notions about things.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I know the thing about the IRS, like, maybe I'm off, you know, maybe that's not. That's my cultural impress.
Mm-hmm.
But segregating out, kind of pulling out those cultural things, you know, there may be a tremendous sense of community among termites. There may be, not in the way that I know community, but mm-hmm. there may be a tremendous, you know, sense of, you know, we are in this together,
yeah.
kind of. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, well, that's okay. And the krill, you know, it might be like, oh, we've got this beautiful clean water, lots of plankton to eat, and all of a sudden, gulp. It's done. The problem with being a termite or a krill is not that there's necessarily no pleasure in that life. The problem is that they can't do anything to make sure that they're going to be better off in the next life. They can't do anything to practice Buddhism and free themselves from samsara entirely. So even if that krill is having a lovely existence until it's eaten, what's going to happen to it next? It's like the pleasures in this life. The pleasures in this life last for a while, and then they're done, and then what comes next? We don't know. So it's the same with the animals. You know, another example would be a pampered golden retriever named Fluffy. Well cared for, gets better medical care than most people on this planet. But can Fluffy practice Buddhism? Can Fluffy practice meditation? Probably not. And so even if it's not even if they're not a bad existence now, what's going to happen next? So it's always looking at the future. And the pleasures of community, you know, what are the termites using community for? Well, termites primarily eat wood, so maybe they're not carnivorous. They may not be killing many animals. But krill, I mean, I don't really know much about krill. I just use them as an example because, whatever, there are many of them. But what do they eat? What do they do to keep that? Do they eat smaller animals, even smaller animals? I guess they probably eat plankton mainly, so they're probably okay in this life until they're eaten up. But they don't have the opportunity to practice Dharma. That's the big point. So we want to make sure that we're able to practice Dharma because, you know, the pleasurable, the not so unpleasant lives in the animal realm are temporary. How long does a termite last?
Thank you.
Well, we're coming to about 12 o'clock now. So I guess we have time for lunch and we'll reconvene at 2 o'clock. But before we do, it's important for us to dedicate the merit. So let's just recite the dedication of merit.
Osanam deitam jezepani tobnenye bedranam pamchene keganache Sure.